Hi, my name is Craig Thompson, local graphic novelist known for Blankets and Habibi, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Welcome to a special episode of Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and today we'll be bringing you some never-before-aired audio featuring Craig Thompson, the celebrated graphic novelist behind the books Blankets and Habibi, as well as the sketchbook travelogue Carnet de Voyage. After a live interview at KBOO in May of 2018, Craig stayed behind in the studio and we just kept talking. It's that informal conversation which you'll be hearing today for the very first time. Before we get started, I'd like to remind all of our listeners that we are currently in the midst of KBOO's All Thrills, No Frills membership drive. We hope that you've been enjoying our programming and that you'll take a moment to pledge your support. We don't have volunteers in the station to take your calls right now, but you can show your support by giving online, kboo.fm, or text KBOO to 44321. KBOO is one of the very last media outlets that still brings you local and independent news, music, and public affairs. We've been doing this here in Portland for over half a century. And this program has been coming to you for 20 years now, inviting important cultural figures into the studio and venturing out to events that might fly beneath the radar of the big media monoliths. So yes, you can support this very special programming today by giving online to kboo.fm/give, or simply text KBOO to 44321. And if you prefer to go analog, we're always happy to receive a contribution in the mail. The address of the station is 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. And now, Craig Thompson, recorded on May 10th, 2018. So yeah, we're back with Craig Thompson, and we're talking about Habibi as well as Carnet de Voyage. So one thing I was kind of interested in with going from the realism of Blankets to I wouldn't call it so much magic realism of Habibi. It's more like mythological, would you say? Flight of fancy. So it's just
yeah, literary. Fairy tale is the term I usually use. Okay. I think I compared it to Star Wars at some point because it draws on all these textures of sort of Morocco or Tunisia or the Middle East, but it doesn't take place in any sort of time period, you know, like it's a galaxy far, whatever, long time ago, far away. And that gave me a lot more freedom. I don't know if I could have done what Joe Sacco does, where he has to like research every single minute detail and get it like precisely right. I wanted to kind of be fast and loose, drawing from different time periods, different regions, geographical regions. I mean, some parts look like America more than they do anywhere in the Middle East.
Well, you know, when Goodbye Chunky Rice was published back in 1999, it was really well received, but it couldn't have prepared you for the reception that Blankets got. I mean, Blankets won numerous Eisner, Ignatz, and Harvey Awards and became an international phenomenon. You've said originally that you kind of intended Blankets as your way of coming out to your parents about disavowing Christianity. But you ended up hearing from other people who you never expected to read the book in the first place, including the real-life family that inspired Raina's family.
Mm-hmm.
So did that
I never heard from her family.
Oh, you didn't hear from the family. Okay.
No. Yeah, it's less interesting than that. But I'd heard from... It was more through the grapevine, friends of friends. So,
okay.
So it's not quite that interesting of a story. But certainly, the book drew people out of the woodwork. And, I mean, it's easiest to talk about my family who my parents specifically, my brother. So I have a sister. Sorry, I'm jumping all over the place.
Oh,
but
no.
I have a sister who's not in the book. A lot of people ask me, you know, is Blankets 100% true? Is this autobiographical to the detail? And I was like, well, everything in it happened for the most part, but the fiction is in the editing and what I've chiseled away and removed. And one of the biggest elements is my sister. My sister didn't really factor into the main story I was talking about my relationship with my brother. And she would have been sequestered to sort of this like almost insignificant background character, which in some ways she was in my childhood. We weren't that close. So in a way, it was strangely more respectful and easy to just edit her out altogether. But there's other things like that too. For instance, I never finished high school. My parents pulled us out of school for Christian homeschooling, which in its own way would be a fascinating graphic novel to talk about that experience. But that was not the story I was telling at the time with Blankets.
Well, you still ended up going to the local, I believe it was the local University of Wisconsin.
Yeah, University of Wisconsin Marathon Center in Wausau.
Okay.
So I went there for a year. I was working full-time at a newspaper as a graphic designer, like a very low-end graphic designer. We were called ad stylists.
Uh-huh.
And I was taking some part-time classes at community college, and I just didn't know what I was doing with my life. So I made some great friendships while I was there, but I was really not a college student. I was some sort of weird part-time, like I'm working full-time at a real job, an adult job, but I have to do something that so my brain doesn't completely disintegrate and melt from this sort of lifestyle.
So you spent a little time in Milwaukee, and then you came out to Portland, one of the most unchurched cities in the country. Has Portland been your muse in a way?
Oh, God, I don't know if I would say that. I hated Portland when I first moved here, and that was 1996. And, I had a friend who talked me into moving here. I was sizing up Seattle because there was a strong cartoonist community there in the 90s that sort of corresponded with what was happening in music. People like Megan Kelso, Jennifer Daydreamer, Tom Hart, David Lasky, Jason Lutz, just
Jim
to name
Woodring
a few.
Jim Woodring is there.
Jim Woodring, yeah. Fantagraphics, which was the most important indie publisher and maybe in the world. So Seattle was the hot spot in my perception, but I had a friend who talked me, this was 1995, 96. She's like, nope, Seattle's the past. That's like grunge. grunge is dead. You got to move to Portland. That's the future. And she was totally right, but I don't know if she was immediately right. When I got here in 1996, I kind of hated it. It just seemed like kind of a seedy, drug-addled, like redneck-y city, really dark and moldy, like the parts of Portland that drive all of us crazy.
It was an old timber town.
Yeah, and I had that feeling, and I had that feeling of sort of criminals, Shanghai tunnels and like junkies. And
well, that's when you first get off the...
I got assaulted so many times when I first moved here. I had lived in a real city in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, but then I got here and I got mugged like three times within a couple months.
Yeah, I mean, that's the Greyhound station, the Amtrak station, right around there. Used to keep people away along with the persistent rain.
Yeah. And but then things started to fall into place for me in Portland. It took about a year, and I got like a real job, which is working at Dark Horse Comics, and I got a better apartment, and it really just, then it all awakened for me when I started finding this artistic community, and Portland really thrived for that reason. Like there was, it seemed like everybody who is young was moving here to live cheaply and make art, and a lot of those people are still some of my good friends here.
Yeah, I mean, it's great to find a community.
Especially for someone who didn't really go to school,
Yeah.
This became my school. Like I found my own little art school collective.
Well, and also there's just not, people don't put on airs here. It's like, I remember one day, and I forget what event it was. It might've been the Platform Festival or something earlier, but found myself in a bar with Bill Plimpton and Shel White and Joan Gratz and Rose Bond. And I just thought, these people are my idols from my youth. I was watching their animation and here I am drinking with them. It's just, I get a little sense of that from Carnet de Voyage as well. You're there with all of these people who are just part of a community, and this is your first time really sitting down as an equal with them, and you're kind of gobsmacked.
Yeah, I'm pretty fanboyish in Carnet de Voyage. And you're speaking specifically of people like Blutch, who's a French cartoonist, who is a major influence on my style, along with Edmond Baudouin. And so, I was a pretty nerdy fanboy around him, and he's definitely an artist whose style I crudely imitated. And I kind of talk about this when I present Blankets, like, oh, here's some scenes from Blankets that I subconsciously ripped off from Blutch, his book Le Petit Christian, which I hope gets translated, which is about his childhood. There's no religious elements in that, but there's still something definitely in the visual style, and there's a few scenes that I almost lifted straight from his book for blankets. And I didn't do it consciously. It was just that I was young and naive and really obsessed with his work. And that sort of just sort of filtered through. And I tell a lot of young cartoonists, like, that's normal. You sort of wear your inspirations on your sleeve, but it's just important to become more and more conscious of that and acknowledge it and then find your own voice too.
I'm trying to remember the quote, something like, steal from one source, that's plagiarism. Steal from many sources, that's art.
True, yeah, yeah. I actually, on that note, you know, with Habibi, there was some accusation around it of cultural appropriation. The new book I'm working on, I had a friend who was warning me about the theme of cultural appropriation. But then another friend of mine who's Chinese said, all art is cultural appropriation. They thought it was kind of ridiculous. And I realized, oh, yeah, right. Yeah, all of art is sort of borrowing from everywhere. And hopefully showing that all these things are universal. These sort of languages are built into us as humans.
Well, there's a quote by Nikki Giovanni that's always stuck with me. Writers don't write from experience. If you wrote from experience, you'd get maybe one book, maybe three poems. Writers write from empathy.
Oh, yeah. That's perfect.
And for Habibi, well, one of your influences was the Turkish writer Elif Shafak, author of The Bastard of Istanbul. Her way of thinking about fiction is as a way to live other lives and in other worlds.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah. Yeah, perfect examples. I don't know what to add to that. But yeah, with Habibi, I was certainly trying to just get out of my own head and experience and live in these characters' lives that were... it's weird to say, though, because, like, in a weird way, Habibi's more personal than any of my other works, in a strange way, because it's so distanced from my own experience and because it's so fictionalized. In a way, you can kind of get to the core of some really honest things. You know what I'm saying?
Well, I know that you've said that Dodola and Zam, who are the protagonists of Habibi, it's an Arab girl and a black boy, they're child slaves, they just came into your head fully formed. Mm-hmm. And the best kind of characters are those that just tell you what they're going to do, where they're going to go.
Yeah, it's sort of like the first nugget of the creative process is sort of a gift given to you by the subconscious or God or whatever you want to say. You know, like it's a dream nugget, you know, like a sort of vision that emerges on a sketchbook page in the same way that images emerge in your dreams. You don't know where they're coming from, but if you're smart enough, you kind of run with the, I don't know, with the symbol. You're like, these characters are, I don't know, they're too good for me to have made up.
You're listening to a special episode of Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Konser, and the guest in the studio is Craig Thompson, author of the graphic novels Blankets, Habibi, and Carnet de Voyage. Before we get back to the conversation, I'd like to take a moment to remind our listeners that KBOO is in the midst of our All Thrills, No Frills membership drive. We hope that you've been enjoying our programming and that you'll take a moment to pledge your support. There are all kinds of ways to join KBOO. On the web, you can visit kboo.fm/give. You can also text KBOO to 44321. And if you prefer to go analog, we're always happy to receive a contribution in the mail. The address of the station is 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Again, the webpage is kboo.fm/give. On your mobile device, you can text KBOO to 44321. And of course, you can reach us by mail at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. And now let's talk some more with our guest, Craig Thompson.
You meet a woman in Carnet de Voyage who talks about dream comics. In fact, there's a whole genre of dream comics. Jim Woodring, who we mentioned, is one great artist of dream comics. But many Europeans, many people from Eastern Europe especially, that's a big genre.
Yeah, why am I spacing on his name right now? The Serbian cartoonist Aleksandar Zograf?
That's it, right? Zograf, yes.
He's incredible. I haven't seen his work recently, though. But yeah, comics are kind of perfect for, they're strangely perfect for autobio stories. There's something about when you're drawing yourself, there's another dimension to the way you can tell personal memoir stories. That's why I think why it's so common in comics. But also dream comics, you know, I don't know if prose or movies or anything really serve interpreting dreams as much as comics.
Yeah, it's perfect because you can jump around. Well, you do that in Habibi. You avoid placing the story in any one time period or even in a single narrative arc.
That's another thing with comics. It's really easy to make leaps in, certainly leaps in time. On a single page, you know, there could be a panel in one time period or, you know, geography. And then the next panels makes a huge leap. But because they're sort of existing on that same 2D plane at the same moment, the reader is able to make the connection. If it happened in prose, you might have to flip back a few pages and find like what you know, you're rereading text, you know, it's kind of complicated. And certainly in cinema where the frames are just washing over you at this rapid movement, it might be hard to like hold on to those connections. But comics, because you can kind of take it at your own pace and you have that obvious visual reference right in front of you, it gives your brain just that extra microsecond or whatever to make the leap.
Yeah, and you can do collage, mm-hmm. even better than montages in film. You can do, you know, a little bit of Rauschenberg style. Bill Sienkiewicz mm-hmm. used to do some great sort of collage art for comics.
Mm, yeah, he's a great example. I talk about Habibi being a bit of a mashup, you know, in the way, or goulash, the way I was drawing from all these different influences and sort of mixing them together in one kettle and really, yeah, sampling a lot of things. You know, the way I used Arabic calligraphy in that book was, I never learned Arabic, either verbal or written language, but it was never arbitrary, the Arabic I was using in the book. But I would sort of find things and sample it and rework them and trace them and draw them in my own style. But it was sort of a weird glorified tracing / mashup collage.
Yeah, a little bit of a mixtape.
Yeah.
Well, and you have the power to create your own world. You created a world in Habibi where there are no guns or televisions, for example, that didn't work with the direction you wanted to take things. And this isn't a perfect analogy, but I thought of the not quite real worlds created by Wes Anderson, the New York of the Royal Tenenbaums, where there are no billboards or fax machines or cell phones or new model cars.
Yeah, no, that's a great comparison. And you must have read somewhere that I said, yeah, with Habibi, I decided I didn't want guns or television sets in there. So otherwise, I'm like, it's not specific to any time or place, you know. It's this fairy tale Middle East. But early in my comics career, I sort of had this promise to myself to not tell stories with guns. We'll see if I adhere to that for my whole life. Actually, there's some war documentation in my current project. But for the most part, I find guns as narrative devices very lazy. And I also think, you know, the fact that they have such a prominent role in our storytelling is why they have such a prominent role in our like real lives, you know, like when we talk about gun violence and, you know, in schools and all this stuff and mass shootings. I think as storytellers, we have a lot of responsibility for using them as narrative devices, you know, and then we always say that we're trying to reflect reality, but in fact, we're creating our reality by making guns such glorified objects in storytelling.
Well, I think it's more effective when you introduce a character or a situation that's monstrous or traumatic, and you do that often. I mean, the characters you draw are generally disarmingly pleasant-looking for the most part, but then there's a shock of there's some demonic figure that appears, and the themes of abuse and survival seem to run through your books. And like you said, having a gun in there might break that tension or might lead to a lazy conclusion.
Yeah, I do think it's lazy. It's weird to me that so many writers write about guns. I don't know. I mean, I know there's people that live through moments of real-life gun violence, and I think they have maybe a little bit more permission, you know. I mean, they should be writing that stuff out. But I think for maybe the average writer, I don't know if they're writing from the right kind of personal experience. But I don't know if I answered your question about about maybe harmless looking people doing horrible things. I feel like you might be talking about the theme of sexual trauma and rape in Habibi, and those were difficult scenes to draw visually for the same reason that I have this rule against guns. It's like, well, how do I depict this really horrible act without one relying on these sort of tropes of turning everything into a monster moment, you know, that's sort of artifice in a way, but I also don't want to sensualize that moment either, you know, like it's a delicate juggling act. Like, you kind of want to try to depict it in a detached sort of way to some degree, and that actually makes it more disturbing than if you imposed your emotional take on it. Does that make sense?
Well, it seems to be another lazy trope to make a villain without any redeeming qualities. The screenwriting rule is that everybody is a hero in their own story.
Hmm. Yeah, that's great.
So everybody's got motivations, and everybody thinks what they're doing is right for some reason.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
But yeah, talking about rape and sexual abuse, it seems like in Habibi there's allegories with environmental degradation and abuse. There's parables between the two. The damage we do to the earth, the damage we do to the people around us, the people in other cultures.
Yeah, and that's a theme that sort of continues through all my books and in my current project too. And maybe that sort of mirrors what I was saying about, like, storytellers are sort of informing in a way some of the gun violence in our country by continuing to tell stories with guns. I think things like sexual violence are somehow a reverberation of, you know, what we are doing to the earth. It's the same energy of violation.
And of violence to people that we can't see in places that are affected by our actions.
Which would be capitalism, yeah.
I mean, there's a lingering image of a boat stranded in the desert in Habibi. I understand that was inspired by a real image of the Aral Sea in Kazakhstan,
exactly.
which is drying up.
Yeah.
From our actions or use
of
water.
Yeah, that's such. So there's a good example of, like, an image I saw in National Geographic or whatever. That was like an image that emerged from a dream, you know, like, oh, I've seen that before in your dream or something. It's such a potent symbol that I had to exploit it. But it's sort of, it's a perfect metaphor for all these things.
Well, you mentioned sensuality, you know, trying not to make these instances of abuse sensual, but it's kind of hard because you do draw a lot of sensual material. And I mean, sensuality doesn't necessarily have to be pleasurable. There's lots of sexual and scatological themes in many of your books. Even in your kids' book, Space Dumplings, there are poop jokes.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, these things are messy. These things are awkward. Bodily functions are the source of humor as well as fascination as well as obsession.
Yeah, and that's true. I mean, of literature in general, like we were talking about the 1001 Nights, you know, or the Bible, or Moby Dick, all of those books have crude humor, scatological humor, sexual humor.
Trickster tales from around the world.
Yeah, exactly. But in a way, it's more shocking when you see it in comics or graphic novels, because it's visual. So when I was working on Habibi, I mean, I worked on that book for 6 years in my isolated studio in Portland, and nothing struck me as that shocking until I remember at this one point I was going through a chapter, like a photocopies of a chapter, while I was on an airplane. And then I became acutely aware of, like, the person next to me looking at what I was doing. And then there was nudity on the page or something. And I hadn't even realized that I was making these pages that weren't necessarily appropriate for general public consumption. But, like, you know, in prose, you can kind of get away with anything. Much more horrible things. And you have to be a little more delicate in graphic novels, apparently.
Well, Habibi was so much more detailed. The artwork was so much more lovingly rendered. And I'm wondering if Carnet de Voyage, that discipline that you took in just getting something down on the page every day and honing your technique, if that really ramped up your game from Blankets to Habibi.
Probably, certainly, anytime I'm just drawing regularly, it's, you know, and sketching, your muscles grow. It's like any kind of exercise, you know? And in fact, drawing, if I'm not doing it regularly, those muscles atrophy pretty quickly. I always say that like it takes about 3 days of drawing before you kind of start to get a groove, and it takes about 3 months of drawing before that work starts being good. And I can feel my skills diminish instantly if I take a week off or something to like build back up those drawing muscles. That, you know, you gotta be doing it regularly. It's like any kind of exercise. It's not like you can be a high school jock that works out in high school and then you're ripped the rest of your life. It's a constant discipline.
I've referred to figure drawing as going to the gym.
Yeah, that's great.
For artists.
That's true.
Because, you know, the human body, the way it twists, there's no straight lines in the human body. There's no front view, there's no side view like you see in the medical charts. But yeah, if you can really get, you can really never just master the contortion of the body. You know, in animation, you never want a pose that's symmetrical. You always want something that's asymmetrical, that's showing weight on one side or the other, mm-hmm. that's showing dynamism on one side or the other.
Oh, that's great too.
Well, it's been great talking with you. I mean, we said that you don't have a date yet or any details yet about your new projects, but is there anything else you want to talk about that we haven't quite covered?
Well, so the new project, I mean, I'll be ready to announce it probably around August or so. And I'll be working on it here in Portland, so that's something. I was gone for a few years in Los Angeles, but I'm back. And otherwise, right now, I'm just trying to like get out the word about the new Carne de Voyage. I'm going to go to Vancouver, BC in a couple of weeks for their comics festival. And there's a great international cast of people they're hosting out there. And yeah, and then it's just get back into my studio, doing the opposite of what I'm talking about with Carne de Voyage. I'm going to hole up in my studio and avoid travel for a while so I can really get productive on this next project.
Well, Craig Thompson, thanks for joining us for extended conversation today.
My pleasure, Conch. Thank you.
Well, we hope that everybody has been enjoying this special episode of Words and Pictures, recorded in May of 2018 and featuring a never-before-aired conversation with celebrated graphic novelist Craig Thompson. Now, before we go, I'd like to remind all of our listeners that this community radio station needs your support. To become a member of KBOO or to arrange for a donation of any size, please visit kboo.fm/give. You can also text KBOO to 44321. Or if you prefer, you can mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Again, the webpage is kboo.fm/give. On your mobile device, you can text KBOO to 44321. And of course, you can reach us by mail at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. You can find an archived version of this show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on social media at Words and Picture.